teaching program that in Africa, of the Africanists generally here, has been one that's been very heavy on the side of graduate student teaching, PhD candidates, MA candidates, and the like, especially PhD candidates. Most of our effort over the decade of the 60s went into that kind of teaching. We turned out a lot of PhDs. I think they were reasonably well trained, but it did mean that we did less with the teaching of undergraduates and less with individual care with undergraduates than we should have done, than we might have done had we not had this enormous load of the other kind of teaching, which is some years we'd have between us as many as 6-7 PhDs, and that's just too many to do a good job. And if you try to do a good job with that, it means that something else has to suffer, so that the undergraduate aspect of our teaching was very much neglected until recent years. This may be inevitable given the teacher-faculty ratios here at a university this size. They are far too large. There are far too many students per faculty member for us to be able to give the kind of personal attention that we might like to give in any event. But that's been one aspect of the teaching program that has to be kept in mind.
Just to continue this for a minute, you seem to suggest that it's the undergraduate part is improving somewhat. Do you?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No. The student-faculty ratio is still far too large. The part of the problem of size comes in here. There are so many undergraduate students that there's no way even a good student can get really good information about what the courses he might like to take. And there are lots of courses that are the popular, well-known ones, which are oversubscribed, and lots of courses that students might like equally well. Were they able to get into them, if they knew about them, that tend to be undersubscribed. And either way, even the undersubscribed ones have quite enough students for the size. I mean, I took any courses today of 30 or 40 students. That's quite enough students for courses, so almost too many, as opposed to 250 or 300 for the big ones. But I don't feel that the students are getting to the right course as well as they should, and I don't know anything that can be done about this. It's simply we have no way of getting information around among students. And this goes back to another problem that you get in looking at the optimum size or the diseconomies of scale, if you put it in economic terms. There's a certain size student body that you need in order to be able to offer certain kinds of specialties. A range of courses in African history might be a kind of specialty that only a very large university could offer. So that there is an advantage of scale here in being able to offer these specialized courses, but you have a disadvantage of scale in that the total number of with that many students, it's very, very difficult for the students to get the kind of guidance they need from faculty and others about what courses they might take. And it's very hard for them to find others of like mind among the student body, so that the anonymity of the individual student's position in the community is made much worse. Whereas in a smaller institution, you would be able to get through the grapevine information about courses that appear to be challenging or interesting. You would be able to get through the grapevine or through casual contact into contact with students of like mind who would share your interests. My feeling here from talking with students is that this is less and less true as time has gone on, so that we've had a trade-off here with the increase in size. and a trade-off that may in some ways be good, I'm not sure yet, but it has certainly has its disadvantages too, very definitely.
Yes, I can see where that that could work that way. How about the what are your feelings about the attitude towards research versus teaching?
Well, this has been a continuous battle. Famous examination that was supposed to have been given at some university. Question was, publish or perish, ? Think before you answer. This is not to be taken that lightly. It's obvious that here in recent years, the official impression that one gets from the university administration and from the governor's office and is one of increasing emphasis on teaching and a de-emphasis on research. Now, this may not be intended, but this is what the impression one gets from the public pronouncements from higher up, and very little is said about research, and very little opportunity is given for research, very little encouragement is given for research by individual faculty members in any way that I'm conscious of. So that you have an impression that the need to justify the university to the taxpayers has in fact shifted the university away from a principal concern or a strong concern with research to a concern with teaching, and not with teaching in quality, but with teaching numbers. And this is one of the reasons that I've been most unhappy with Wisconsin in recent years, is the growing anonymity. I mentioned before the student, but there's also growing anonymity in the way that faculty is treated by the university, and the impression one gets from the official pronouncements is that the only thing that counts is teaching lots and lots of students, so that everything is to be sacrificed to quantity. And this is true throughout the country, it's not just true here, the numbers game begins to be played, enrollments get to be important. This can have all kinds of bad consequences, one of which is that it contributes to some extent to the inflation of grades. And I guess everybody knows that a B now is what a C used to be 10 years ago. And this kind of inflation of grades is going on quite consistently through the whole academic world. And the numbers game, the search for enrollments, which are going everywhere, probably has some part in this. And this is just a Wisconsin problem, but it's part of the problem. I don't know how you would re-emphasize the university's role as a research institution, as a factor, a part of the university administration, because right now the governor is probably right in thinking that the taxpayers do not want to feel that they are paying for research on obscure topics, and that you'd have more taxpayer rebellion against the university's policies if there were a major emphasis on research than you do at present. So this may be simply a problem that a state university has to live with, although my own sense is that if the governor's office had tried to do more of a job in educating the people about the total contribution of the university to the state, they would have had a better reception than they have. I recall a conversation with David Adamany when he was still a member of the political science department. He's supposedly close to the governor now in these matters, and he was telling a number of us at Willard Hurst's house that he thought that we professors had better wise up and get to work and teach the taxpayers' children and stop fiddling around with research in their own private projects the way we've been doing in the past. Well, if this represents, I guess most of us thought this represented what the governor thought too. And it made some people quite livid because, as it turned out, almost everybody there had in fact raised from outside funds the money, not only for their own research, but for the research of other people. And in the case of someone like Charles Reed in the medical school, was a person who was in this conversation, I remember, his grants that he brings in to the university support not only his salary, but the salary of quite a few other people. And the money that I've raised over the years for the university considerably exceeds the amount that the university's paid me. Well, this money, if it hadn't gone here, would have gone some other place, some other university. So this is raised from national sources, not from sources in the state. So that, in a sense, these people that the governor thinks of as useless because they're not teaching are, in fact, bringing assets into the state in the form of jobs that wouldn't be here otherwise, but they're also contributing through their research to human knowledge, which is an indirect benefit to the state in all kinds of ways. So certainly a very direct benefit to the nation, if not to the state, but it does also benefit the state too. And this tends to be overlooked, I think, in the attitude that's been taken in recent years. I've heard nothing from Weaver, for example, that in any public pronouncement that suggests that he's conscious of this function in the university, nor from the governor, nor indeed from anyone else that I can think of in authority, mainly because they're so concerned with the matter of getting any budget at all, perhaps, rather than trying to be concerned with getting a kind of budget that would maximize the university's contribution.
Perhaps part of this is, as you suggested, inadequate public relations around the state. How about the pressure to publish?
Oh, that's not the problem. The good teachers are also the good publishers. There are a few exceptions. There are some people who are good teachers who don't publish much. But the good researchers are also good teachers. And the pressure to publish is... Well, the pressure to publish is there, whether it's put there or not. The thing that gives a scholar visibility is a contribution as a researcher to his field of knowledge. There are a few people who contribute nothing in the way of writing to the field of history and who have made considerable reputations as teachers of history. But in fact, a historian is somebody that writes history. You can't be a great historian and not write history, because that's what historical work is. You can't be a great chemist without making discoveries in the field of chemistry. You may be a great teacher, but you're not a great chemist. And the individual career will not be noted if one is merely a great teacher or a good teacher without making any contribution to knowledge. And therefore, the individual will simply not have any visibility on the national or international scene unless he publishes. The pressure here is not, to publish, let's put it another way, there is a kind of pressure on the person who doesn't want to publish, who just wants to have a happy life teaching, not working very hard, that he should publish in order to get tenure, after which he stops forever, and that man does feel pressured to publish. But that's got a person who probably shouldn't be given tenure in the first place, because he did his publishing only because he did it to get tenure. But if you want to have a first-rate university with a faculty that is contributing to knowledge, then the publication will be automatic. They'll go on and publish because that's the kind of people they are. And you would have hired them because they intended to publish, and they will also be your best teachers.
And also, this transcends to any one institution.
Yeah, it can go anywhere.
Need is beyond one place.
There is an argument that many people who are adequate teachers don't need to publish. That's quite right. That's true. But if there are places where teaching is really the major objective, where discovery of new truths to teach is not considered to be important, where the research side of things is played down, that's the direction this university is now going. And in those places, there are plenty of opportunity for people who don't want to publish. So that I don't see that the pressure to publish is necessarily a bad thing. I think that the man who was trying to teach history or any other subject at a graduate level, where he's trying to teach people to be historians, if he is not himself a historian in the sense that he is currently writing history, will not be able to do a very good job of teaching somebody else to do the job. If he is trying to teach undergraduates what happened in history, in effect, that's another matter. But since this university has made its biggest contribution in this campus, in any event, in teaching of graduate students to be historians, then this is the kind of people you have to have here. And this, in fact, is what, as I've suggested, what's happening. You see it running through a lot of aspects of the university, and this is now shifting over to one of the reasons why I'll be leaving Wisconsin, is the fact that the general discouragement with the idea that the university should be a university with national visibility and a national research role, that it should be one of the great universities. And I sometimes say, and to myself and hear others say, that we're going the route that Ohio State went already. The discouragement of out-of-state students is one very strong example. 10 years ago, people from all over the country, indeed all over the world, would come to Wisconsin because it was a great university, and it was a great university to a very large measure because they were here as students. The student body was exciting, and the student coming here could meet people that he wouldn't otherwise see, could get a broader view of the world, could get a lot from his fellow students. Now, with the closing down, our discouragement of out-of-state students, very high tuition fees and the like, we are drawing more and more a local group. It's becoming more and more an institution that just serves the state, that isn't seeking to have to maintain its position as a national university. And that there is a role, perhaps, for a place like Ohio State, but it isn't a great university, and therefore there's no reason why somebody who wants to have a contribution to scholarship or research should stay around if the institution is not oriented toward the kind of thing he's interested in. And I think this is part of the problem that we see more and more, with a very bad morale among the research-oriented people here.
Do you see mergers having a sort of very real effect in this, or is this just a side issue?
I didn't think it would have an effect when it was first talked about, and I was on the whole in favor of merger. It didn't work so far because they didn't go and close down some of the institutions that should have been closed down completely. They didn't, in fact, get out the dead wood in the whole system that they needed to get out in order to make it a more efficient and tight operation. There was dead wood here. There were inefficiencies in the whole organization. I have not seen any evidence in areas I know about, and this is not a well-informed answer because I don't know the whole university. In the areas I know about, I've not seen any evidence that the things have improved very much, that the improvement that might have been possible with merger came about. And I have seen evidence that the merger has distracted people regarding the whole university system from seeing the parts very clearly. I think the merger is one reason why the governor's office tends to talk so much about the teaching function, where you have people in the governor's office and the central administration talking about productivity and the like, as though you could measure productivity in a process that's essentially creative. one where you're trying to discover new truth. How can you be more productive discovering more new truths today and yesterday? It's obviously ridiculous. It's even ridiculous to talk about productivity in terms of student bodies and classes, because there's no measure of quality here, but only quantity. And that's just part of the general problem.
Specifically, you've said a great deal that suggests changes in the university and what isn't now the way it was. Specifically, do you have any additional reasons for wanting to leave?
Oh, yes. I'd have to be quite frank that there's one reason is that I've recently got divorced and remarried, and I've married a fellow historian. And the structure of the position of Madison and being away from any major center means that it's impossible for her to get a job here. So that if we were to stay here as a couple, she would have to find work outside of her field of specialty, outside of history, that is, and then the work she's done toward her PhD would have been completely wasted. Many people come here as couples and find some kind of work, but broadly speaking, the anti-nepotism tendency is still very strong here. And there's simply no other academic employment in the vicinity. So that in my own case, I would find this as some reason for leaving. It's not the main reason. And it would have been possible next year for her to have a job in Chicago, and she could have commuted down there 3 days a week.
That's a fairly long commute.
Well, that's the kind of thing people put up with now. But there is a problem here that Madison has, a disadvantage that bigger centers don't have. There simply is no alternative source of employment. And if you have two people in very much the same field, there's no way to give them both jobs. And that is something I think that the university simply can't do anything about, but it's a problem. This is this is not why I'm leaving, however. I'm leaving this
Tell
is
me about
an additional
your
problem.
Main reason.
My main reason is an opportunity to go somewhere else, right, where some of the things that bother me here aren't going to be the case. And I'm going to a mainly research-oriented job at approximately $10,000 more than I'm now making, where this is simply financially, it's an enormous difference, including fringe benefits. The difference is about almost $20,000 a year more than I'm making in Wisconsin, and I can't afford to stay. Frankly, there's I can't, with children to send to college and the like, and between us we have six coming up to college now, I can't afford Wisconsin. That's the main reason right there. Then the all these other problems I mentioned, the increasing anonymity of Wisconsin, it used to be an easy place where you could know people in other departments. It's very hard to know the people in other departments here. The structure of the departmental setting is one that where I find my contacts are more and more within the history department and less within a total university setting. I find that the anonymity of the students is disturbing. I find that the discouragement of research and out-of-state students are both discouraging. I find that there is a general pattern, indeed, of that isn't just my own case, of set in salary structure, that the salary structure at the top is very bad here. Let me just give an example of the job I'm taking. At Johns Hopkins, it's been in the newspapers, and he's making a secret of it. I will be making the $36,500 as against $28,800 I'm now getting in Wisconsin. At that salary, If I say to Wisconsin, Wisconsin made a counteroffer of $31,000. At that counteroffer, if had I stayed and accepted the counteroffer, I would have been the highest paid member of this department. And the department has 60-odd people in it. At Johns Hopkins, where I'm going, with a salary almost $6,000 more than that, I will be the third highest paid of a department of only 20.
It's quite a difference.
And this is a big difference. Places other than Wisconsin simply pay a lot more money to the top people. And you can see this through the whole structure of the university. No one who ever got a Nobel Prize here stayed here after he got the Nobel Prize. Or if you look at another index, what's happened to people in this department, some people have left by being discouraged in various ways, but not by being fired, people who had tenure. But there's been a fairly systematic tendency of people in history to get to a certain level in their career, and if they've been successful, then Wisconsin can't any longer keep them because Wisconsin isn't paying enough, or otherwise making itself competitive with other places. And I was interested in seeing this spring's elections to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, where there were three historians elected this year with a Wisconsin background.
You're one.
I am one. One was a man named Ebert, who had been in the history of science and moved to Harvard, and another was David Herlihy, who was here for a long time and has just moved to Harvard. So that the minute all three of us, or just around about the time all three of us got to the point where in our career where this kind of honor was deemed appropriate, we were either gone or on our way. And this kind of pressure on the top people in reputation and age is has been fairly continuous, and I think will get worse because as the salary raises stay as low as they are. And I don't like to make it an economic matter because I feel a great loyalty to the university, and I feel a loyalty to what I think we build up here and the field I've been interested in. It's not been a personal thing, but a group of us have done things that I think I have great pride in. But I do feel, nevertheless, that my possibility of my making a further contribution here is now getting less and less, and that even if the salary matter were equal, that it's about the time in my own career to try somewhere else and see if these factors that tend to hold down any kind of innovation or change within the structure here cannot be remedied or cannot be got around a little better in some other setting.
You seem to describe it as a kind of growing trend of dissatisfaction. I know that you must have had offers before this one that it didn't accept. But you make it sound as though the trend is sort of downward in terms of what you think you can do here.
Well, everybody thinks that. I mean, this is the trend is downward here. There's nobody thinks otherwise. The only reason the university is still functioning at all is that it's downward all over the country, so that there's no place the dissatisfied people can go to. But if you went down the hall here if I could if I had jobs to offer at Hopkins, say, to my principal colleagues and along this hall at salaries
equal to what they now have, but with the knowledge that Hopkins has regularly been paying an 8% in salary increase every year in recent years, and tends to go on doing this, with just that much, I could hire away the whole department. They don't have that. They can't be. The other universities are not competing the way they once were. But this department would disappear tomorrow if their people had an equal chance, or chance to go somewhere else where some of the problems that have now beset this department were not besetting other departments, other places.
This is maybe sort of just asking too much, but do you have any? Do you think that this is uniquely true of the history department? Do you think that this is perhaps true in other areas of the university?
I don't know.
I know this is speculation.
This is probably. I simply don't know. The fault is part of this thing that I'm mentioning, that I haven't got contact anymore with people. Maybe it's my fault. I don't have the contact with people in other fields that I once had. I think, you know, just going back and this off the subject, but going back to the way Trip Common used to be in the early 60s, where you could go in and there'd be tables of people having lunch, and you could sit down and join somebody, and you'd meet a few new people you didn't know, and meet some of the old people you did know, and have a chance to, just as a lunch setting, to see new people. The faculty club still does go on, but it's a very small group that eat there.
Faculty club's even more most specialized.
And most people now bring bag lunches, so they don't get out of their departments. And the faculty, that kind of broad contact, use of lunch hours, kind of contact with one's fellow scholars in other fields, is disappearing. There's also a strong feeling among people in the department here that the contact within the department is getting much worse than it was a few years ago. And Mike Petrovich this past year tried to get the faculty, use the faculty, brought forward a proposal to try to use the faculty lounge as a place where people might meet more often, even if it was somewhat artificially begun at first. And he expressed at that time a concern that